Welcome to the 75th episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Douglas Brerer, who will be sharing memories of some of Pittsburgh's old gay haunts, including the Tender Trap, Trapeze, and Traveler Social Club. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Well, hello, Art. How are you?
Excellent. So this is our 75th interview.
Wow.
You're lucky number 75. And I understand that most of your bar experience revolves around the Pittsburgh scene, which we haven't really covered in any detail yet. So I'm looking forward to hearing some of these stories. And you mentioned that your first gay bar experience was when a college roommate dragged you in summer of 78 to the Venture Inn.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about the Venture Inn. What was it like? What was the environment like? Where was it?
Well, it was downtown Pittsburgh. It was right on Liberty Avenue, which is, you know, where a lot of the bars and the strip clubs and the massage parlors and things like that were located. You walked in and again, you know, I guess it was pretty common for the time period. The bars were dark, you know, it was kind of like they didn't want you to see what was going on, or, you know, you really couldn't, unless you were like directly up in somebody's face, really even see what they looked like. I mean, they had a dance floor, they had a DJ who was actually very good. I guess maybe it was just me. I did not like that kind of atmosphere, that darkened cave-like back room type thing. If I wanted to go to a back room, I mean, there were enough of them in the city I could go to, or, you know, quarter movies, but I didn't want that in a bar.
So was it like one of those kind of woodsy, undecorated blah decor bar?
Well, I mean, when the lights were down, yeah, that's what it was. But, you know, as it ended up, when the bar closed, or, you know, close to closing, I don't know why I happened to be there, but I was in there when the lights were up, and I know that somebody did save them, thank God. But there were these beautiful, like, bows. That's what they're. They were Beaux-Arts murals on the walls with these spectacular, you know, hand-carved gilded frames. And it's just like, well, why wouldn't you be highlighting those in a bar? But I guess that wasn't the image they wanted to portray. But like I said, they were removed and saved. But, you know, it was just... I don't know. My friends, that was their favorite bar. They loved it. And, you know, that's why, there's always, you know, in most cities, there's how many bars? Because, you know, there's a bar for everybody's taste. I mean, that bar was actually darker than the extended weekend that a friend and I, we went to D.C., and we went to the Eagle in Exile. The Eagle in Exile wasn't that dark. So, but then they also like to go around the corner-ish to the Loose Balloon. Oh, I guess I should mention. I also had an incident one night with the doorman at the Venture, because at the time, Pennsylvania required you not only to have a driver's license, you had to have to show that you were 21 and you were legally entitled to enter in a bar. You had to have what they called an LCB card. And I thought, why would I want to pay you for another card when I'm already paying for a license? So I didn't have one, but a lot of times when I went to the bars, because I had studied abroad my senior year, I had my passport. So I go in the Venture now. This wasn't, you know, the first time. And the guy wasn't going to let me in because I didn't have an LCB card. So I pull out my passport. And he was like, I can't accept that. And I looked at him. I said, I can get out of the fucking country with this thing. And you're not going to let me into this hole? It's like, I'll go elsewhere. And that was the last time I ever even tried to go to the Venture Inn. So, like I say, I would go, if I was downtown, it was to go to the Loose Balloon primarily.
And that's an interesting name for a bar. I don't think I've run across another gay bar that was called the Loose Balloon or anything remotely close to it. What kind of bar was it?
Well, it was kind of, well, during the day, it was a restaurant. So it had, I can't say it was a New York feel or a West Coast feel, but, you know, the chairs were all chrome with rattan seats and backs. There was there were lots of plants everywhere. And the room was on two levels. You walked in and there was the main area where at night there were some tables, but it was primarily a dance floor and the DJ. And then you could go down steps and then there were tables. And then that whole end of the room was floor to ceiling, like smoke gray glass, but it wasn't heavy. It wasn't a dark tint. So you could actually see out into the street, you know, what was going on, people walking by. And Miss Angie was the DJ there. And of course, and again, she was absolutely phenomenal. You know, I mean, I can still picture her, you know, frozen in time at the turntables playing, you know, Donna Summer's MacArthur's Park. But it was just a really nice atmosphere. And I got to know all of the wait staff. I mean, I knew all of them by name, you know, and of course, ultimately they knew me from, you know, my time working in the bar as well. Because, I mean, the bar community is a very small community. Pittsburgh's not a huge city. So the bar community, you know, you pretty much know everybody that works in the bar. And, you know, and when you're the doorman at a bar, it's really important to know that.
So the...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
From what you said earlier, I'm guessing, based on the time frame and the description, that Venture Inn was predominantly a bar for men.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I honestly don't ever remember seeing a woman in the Venture Inn. No, other than maybe Vivian, she might have gone there, but I can't picture any of the other women going into the Venture Inn.
I know at that time, because I had my first gay bar experience in 77, and okay. I know at that time there were a lot of bars that were skewed heavily, either male or female, in the gay community. Some of them were a little more mixed. The Loose Balloon sounds like it might have had some female clientele.
The Loose Balloon was very, very much mixed. And I don't know if it had, they were the only bar to my knowledge, at least at the time, that wasn't owned by, you know, gay men or, you know, a group of gays. Don and Roberta, husband and wife, were the owners of the Loose Balloon, nicest people in the world. But ultimately that was their demise. They were targeted. Talk about reverse discrimination. They were targeted because they weren't queer bar owners. Wow. And so, you know, it went under.
How long do you think they lasted? Was it a few years or was it a decade?
I you know, to be honest, I don't even think, from the time that I started going there, I bet it wasn't even a year. Two years. But see, once I started, I didn't have a car. And, you know, I mean, I moved into the city to do my grad work. So I really wasn't in the mood, you know, to jump on a Port Authority bus to go downtown, you know, to go bar hopping, you know, unless my friends were picking me up. And then I went wherever, you know, wherever they wanted to go. but so to get, so we either ended up, if they were driving, it was either the Venture or it was the Loose Balloon. But then once I started working at the bar, I didn't have a lot of free time to go to bars.
So one other bar that you mentioned to me briefly was El Greco. What was El Greco?
It was a hole in the wall. And I'm being kind.
A little dive.
It was the epitome, as I mentioned earlier. It's what most people in the 70s, if you would have said gay bar, that's exactly what they would have thought of. A very dark place, just a very seedy atmosphere. I mean, you could barely see your hand in front of your face. The place was so dark. So I don't know how people even knew what they were drinking, let alone how the bartenders even knew what to make or how to make it.
And there were a lot of those back in those days. Now, after you started going to those bars, I was reading an article, a little newsletter that was put out by the Pittsburgh Queer History Project Lucky After Dark.
Lucky After Dark.
And they interviewed you for that. They included your story in there. And you mentioned that at some point, I'm guessing a couple of years after, like either the end of grad school or after grad school, you started working at the Tender Trap. Is that correct?
Actually, I started working at the Tender Trap while I was in grad school. The first week of grad school, I discovered that my work study program had fallen through. Now, the housing and my, and everything else was covered, but we were on our own as far as board. There was a communal kitchen on the dormitory floor, but like I said, if you wanted to buy groceries, that was out of your pocket. So I was like, I've got to do something. I've got to find some kind of job that I can fit in with my schedule. Now, from where the grad school still there, where they're located, to where the Tender Trap was I don't think it was more than six blocks. I mean, it was a straight shot from the grad school to the bar.
And that was convenient.
Oh, it was great. I mean, stupid me, because, it was at the time they were doing redevelopment, so it wasn't the greatest of neighborhoods to be walking through. 9 o'clock at night wasn't too bad. Probably wasn't the greatest thing to be walking, at 2:30 in the morning. But nothing ever happened to me. Unlike one of my classmates, who was held up at gunpoint. I at that point treated it like it was just a neighborhood bar. And it was a very classy looking place. I mean, because there was an upstairs, there was a downstairs. The upstairs was more of a lounge-ish type of area where there were tables, there was a pit with a Chickering Baby Grand, because it had been a jazz club at one point in time. And then at the back, there was what we called the living room, which was just, sofas and chairs, on three sides of the room. And then one of those big coffee tables in the center with the, the typical, big glass bowl with either calla lilies in it or, some floral arrangement. And then downstairs was the dance floor and the DJ. So that became my neighborhood hangout. And I was in one night and I saw that they had a posting that they were looking for bartenders and waiters. So I thought, there's the answer to my problem. So I applied and they tried me out as a bartender and decided I would be better off as a cocktail waiter. It's like, fine, whatever. It's still money.
And you had a distinction, from what I understand, in that article of being known as the dancing waiter. So yes. You were not just a waiter. You were kind of a celebrity waiter there, twirling through the crowd.
Yes, it did. It didn't start off quite that way, but how that even evolved was, the way I'm talking now, you'd never know it. But I'm very much an introvert, and so it was one of those things. It's like, okay, well, what can I do that will make people want to talk to me, as opposed to me having to be the one to break the ice? So how I came up with that, I can't even remember. But my friends to this day still talk about it. The fact that for two straight years, yes, I could dance through a crowd, a shoulder to shoulder crowd. And people made way for me, believe me. But never once lost a drink off of a tray, never spilled a tray, which still boggles people's minds because they can't understand how I balanced a tray through a crowded room.
Now, the neighborhood that the Tender Trap was in had a reputation, I think, from what I've seen in some of the research I did. You mentioned that the Tender Trap itself used to be a jazz club. But that area in general had numerous jazz. It was kind of a jazz nightlife clubbing scene prior to the Tender Trap opening up there. What was the name of that neighborhood? It had a quirky name.
They like to call it Shady Side.
That's
technically,
it
it was not Shady Side. Shady Side did not start. The neighborhood boundaries in Pittsburgh, it's like a drunk person drew them, okay? There are no straight lines anywhere. I mean, they just go around. And Shadyside and East Liberty, how they meet, it's one of those neighborhoods. Shadyside doesn't start, let's see, because that would be the next cross street would be Alder. Shadyside technically doesn't start for like another three blocks. Because at that point, Walnut is the delineation between Shadyside and East Liberty. Because I lived right at the corner and I had a 15206 zip. The people across the street from me had a 15232 zip code. And it also was a different phone exchange. Mine was a 362. Theirs was a 662.
That's strange how they drew those lines back then.
Yeah, it did. It never made any sense to me. It still doesn't make any sense to me. But yeah, it was. You know, at the time, it was. Well, it still is. It doesn't have the same panache that it did back in the '70s because Walnut Street. I'm trying to think. Walnut Street at that time was very much like South Street was or is. I haven't been to Philadelphia in years. But, you know, it was, you know, kind of the place to go. It was the place to go bar hopping. It was where you had, you know, all these little boutique shops that weren't anywhere else in the city.
So it was kind of an artsy, trendy neighborhood.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It was, you know, Shadyside was also and has been known as a gay neighborhood for years, even when I moved into the city. That's, you know, if you, you know, it was probably one of the more expensive neighborhoods and continues to be one of the more expensive neighborhoods in Pittsburgh, you know, inner city neighborhoods, I should say.
So Tender Trap, you said, was kind of a more upscale, nicer environment. What was the clientele like? Was it, did it have a broad spectrum of age or was it mostly, you know, young professionals or what kind of crowd did they draw there?
It drew a really broad crowd. I mean, everything from, you know, I mean, I can remember, you know, the students, you know, the kids coming in from Carnegie Mellon and coming in from Duquesne. But then you also had professionals. you also had some very, very well-to-do people coming in. I could drop a name, but even though they're dead, I don't know how the family would react, so I won't. But, you know, I mean, this was, you know, somebody who was a multimillionaire. You know, he would come in and he would ask if he could, he would come to the door and he would ask to speak to one of the owners, and he would ask if he could cash a check. And so he would cash a $50 check, and that was his money for the evening. And when he ran out, he called the limo, he called the driver, and they picked him up and took him home. So, I mean, you really had everything. The group that always made me laugh was a lot of times straight couples would come in, but they were straight couples that were having trysts, because it was a safe place for them to meet, because they knew they weren't going to run into anybody they knew.
Or so they thought.
A couple of my coworkers from, you know, a few years down the road from my daytime job were shocked because I knew him and his wife, and he comes walking in with his, you know, his girlfriend, and the look on his face, I was just like, uh-huh. And he didn't know what to do. So, but I also knew some straight people who just used to love to come. They loved coming there because of the party atmosphere.
And did they have a dance floor too? Was it a?
There was a dance floor downstairs. It wasn't a huge dance floor, but, you know, per the time, it had the raised lit Saturday Night Fever dance floor. And then the DJ booth was right against the dance floor.
How long did Tender Trap last, you know?
The Tender Trap started, if memory serves me correct, they started in 1970, it was either 76 or 77. When I left in 81, and I don't think it lasted past 82. You know, when it originally started off, when it was still a jazz bar, it was a straight owner, okay? And then he talked two gay men who were lovers at the time into joining him in partnership with the bar. It was just failing as far as a jazz club at that point. So they agreed. So what they did was they kept the upstairs as a jazz club for the time being, and then turned the downstairs into the gay bar. And I think initially that was only open on the weekends, and it had its own, it had a side entrance. And then as business upstairs continued to fall off, then they just took the whole bar. Well, fast forward a few years, Jeffrey and Michael are no longer lovers. Michael buys Jeffrey out, so it's now just Michael and Dick. But it wasn't, even though it was a 50-50 partnership, at least on paper, that's not how the bar ran. So it reached a point where Michael was just like, I've had enough. And he basically just walked out one night and walked away from it all.
So then you also mentioned another bar in Pittsburgh called the Trapeze. And I know
that was that was downstairs from the Tender Trap.
Okay. Because I've noticed in some of the memorabilia that I've discovered, it says on there Tender Trap / Trapeze. Yep. So the Trapeze is what they called the gay bar.
Yeah, that was initially downstairs.
So it's the same building, same owner, same operation. They just
same everything.
Okay.
Yeah. It was confusing for a lot of people at the beginning. You know, people like, well, is this the Tender Trap, or is this the Trapeze? And it's like, you know, it's it's kind of like when people say, well, do you go by Doug or by Douglas? It's like, it really doesn't matter because I've been called worse. So the bar, it was the same thing. But most people usually refer to it as the Tender Trap.
Okay. Now, you mentioned another bar that was kind of important to you in Pittsburgh, and that was the Traveler's Social Club.
The Traveler's Social Club, correct.
Was that actually a bar? Did they serve liquor there, or was it the kind of club where you either brought your own liquor or they had?
No, that would have been the 2001.
Okay.
The Cherche la Femme Cabaret. That was pretty much the, well, there was, see, Travelers was the newest incarnation of the old House of Tilden, which was one of the gay after hours clubs.
Okay.
So what happened was Port Authority decided that they were going to put a new bus station terminal in East Liberty, and where the House of Tilden sat was right where they wanted to put it. So Lucky had to find a new location. Now, the original House of Tilden had been a restaurant slash mobster hangout during like the 20s and the 30s. So architecturally, it was a lot of fun just to go in there and look at the stuff. It wasn't huge, but they had pack people in there. So then they moved, and Lucky found a place down on Hamilton Avenue, which had already been a social club. So he didn't basically, you know, he could just basically like move in, you know, and set up shop. He didn't have to do anything. But, you know, you had to be a member. And I don't even remember what time we opened. Now, the biggest difference with the Travelers as opposed to the House of Tilden was the Travelers actually had a dining room and an actual commercial kitchen. So they had a chef, they had a wait staff. So you could go in, you could go in early, you could get dinner, and then you could go up, head upstairs later on for drinks and dancing, because, you know, they had an enormous dance floor. Probably one of, at that point, yeah, probably was one of the larger dance floors in the city, because by then the 2001 was gone, because their big claim to fame was they had a dance floor that was half the size of a football field.
That is a large dance floor.
It was huge. And of course they had a stage, you know, and they brought in live performers. Grace Jones, you know, rode onto the stage on a microphone, on a motorcycle. Oh my God. You know, they had Madeline Kane come in, and she, or not Madeline Kane, not Ruff Diamond. Oh, Hotshot, Karen Young. She came in and performed. Vicky Sue Robinson also came to the 2001 to perform. Unfortunately, she went on stage very, very late because she was a bad girl at the Tender Trap.
Oh.
She was so, I mean, we'd had a lot of celebrities through there. I mean, I met Gloria Gaynor twice. The Three Degrees came through. Like I said, Grace Jones came to the bar. I met Chaka Khan's sister there. You know, I mean, we were always, because our DJ was a Billboard reporter, so he was very well connected in the music industry. But she came in and was just probably one of the most obnoxious celebrities I've ever met. So they proceeded to get her totally and completely smashed. They had to carry her out of the bar. So she didn't go on for, I think she was 3 hours late going on because of us. So hopefully she learned a lesson.
Hopefully.
But yeah, it was, now that was a place where it was, you paid a cover and it was a BYOB. And that was really the only competition that the two after hours clubs had, because you didn't have to be a member. It was also a place which was kind of important to me as well, because that's the place where the city's drag queens, that's where they were safe. Because the climate would change, you know, the way we change underwear, as to whether drag queens were welcome in bars or not on any given week, let alone any given day. But as to 2001, that was their domain. You were the interloper.
So the focal point at 2001 was the big dance floor, and I assume the drag shows, because if the drag queens were going there, there were obviously going to be a lot of drag shows.
Yes, that's where they held the Miss Pittsburgh, originally before Pegasus came onto the scene. That's where they held the Miss Pittsburgh pageants. And like I say, that's where, you know, all the drag queens, that's where they would congregate.
And what was the draw at the Travelers? What was their big, you know, thing that people went there for? Was it dancing?
It was primarily dancing. See, now at the, you know, at the difference between the Travelers and the 2001 is with 2001, it's a BYOB. You know, you were paying a $6 flat cover, and that covered all of your mixers. So even if you weren't drinking, you know, that meant your sodas were free all night. You know, if you wanted to drink orange juice all night, you know, you were covered.
That's pretty cool.
It was great. But the fun thing, of course, you know, back 78, 79, you know, they really need to redo the saying, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, because it really should be sex, drugs, and disco. Because, you know, there were tables, you know, the standing cafe tables all around the dance floor, you know, in some places three deep, and on the sides of the dance floor, you know, they might go five or six deep. And everybody would come in, you know, they'd throw their bags of weed on the table, and it was just like tailgating. You just hop from table to table, you know, couple hits here, couple hits there, hit the dance floor, back to somebody else's table, couple more puffs, and it was great. I mean, and people, you know, people danced all night. I mean, I can remember coming out of there as the sun was coming up. I mean, I felt like a still out of Nosferatu.
So this was at Travelers, right?
No, this was at the 2001.
Oh, 2001.
That's what I say. That was the biggest competition to the Travelers and to the Nore, the other after hours club. But again, as fate would have it, one of the Pittsburgh's sports stadiums needed the land that the 2001 was on, so it's now a parking lot.
And that has happened to so many gay bars in so many cities, some of which were around for 30 or 40 years. And
does not surprise me.
Through gentrification and, you know, expansion and all this other stuff, development, they've gone the way of the dodo bird.
Yep.
Now, you mentioned somebody earlier in passing named Lucky. And that was Robert Johns, correct?
Robert Johns,
so
correct.
So who is Robert Johns in perspective of the gay nightlife community in Pittsburgh back then? Apparently, he owned several bars.
Well, over time, I mean, he was the original owner of the Holiday, which was a bar in Oakland, just a block down the street from Carnegie Mellon University. That's where all, you know, the gay students used to go. And it was a hole in the wall, but it was a neighborhood hole in the wall. Not like the El Greco. I could actually see people in the Holiday. But the Holiday was really small, and it could get uncomfortably crowded. And it didn't seem like their air conditioners ever worked. So it was just always hot in there. But I knew that, you know, I knew the two owners, you know. So, trying to think. So Lucky owned that prior to, let me see. I think prior to the House of Tilden, Lucky had a bar called the Transportation Club. Again, an after hours club. And that was on the Boulevard of the Allies. Now that club had a mysterious fire. And so he ended up moving, you know, and creating the House of Tilden. There might have also been a fallout. No, because I think DB was also a partner there. But don't hold me to that. Then when they started the House of Tilden, then he had a business partner, DB. And then when they went from the House of Tilden to the Travelers Social Club, it was also Lucky and DB. But he really was kind of, especially in the latter years after the Valentine's Day raid at Travelers, where there were so many, the police, you know, hauled off, I don't even know how many gay men in paddy wagons, and like physically abused and sexually abused these guys with nightsticks. And so Lucky formed, you know, the Pittsburgh, the Lambda Legal Defense Fund. So there, a lot of things got started because of Lucky. But, you know, he was kind of the king of nightlife in Pittsburgh. You know, he knew everybody. He had connections everywhere. And, you know, he was, you know, if you were his friend, you were in like Flint. But he was not somebody to trifle with or, you know, to cross his path. You know, I was lucky in that, you know, he was a friend of mine. He dated a friend of mine at one point. So I got to know him in a way that most, like, bar, you know, bar people that go to the bars never ever got to know him. It was a sad day, you know, when we lost him. So
I think read somewhere too that the Pittsburgh AIDS Project or something got started at Travelers, maybe. Was it Travelers?
It may very well have, because I'm trying to think. I either started at Travelers in 83 or 84. I took a little bit of a break, you know, from working in bars, because I'd sort of had it up to here with queers. But then I went back, because, you know, it was something I knew. So, but there were a lot of characters along the way, that's for sure. And some characters that, you know, most people would probably be terrified to even talk to. Like I don't know if you're familiar with the name Dante Tex Gill.
I am not.
Tex Gill was one of, for lack of a better term, you know, Pittsburgh's mobsters. You know, Tex, he had his hand in, you know, massage parlors and whorehouses. And, you know, there were certain precincts that were paid off. And, you know, every time they thought they had Tex, you know, Tex either got off on a technicality, or I heard of instances, you know, those beautiful Italian aluminum briefcases. When they would go in for the arraignment, it just so happened that one of those Italian aluminum suitcases would be left behind full of money. So an arraignment date was never set. So Tex literally got away with murder for years. And there was probably in the early 80s, what they called the massage parlor wars between one of her and one of her competitors. And they were basically trying to kill each other to see who killed the other first, so they would become, you know, head of it all. So her competitor tried, sent a bomb to her. If he thought he was in the building at the time, and if memory serves me correct, they had a whorehouse that was downtown. It was above the El Greco. Well, this bomb goes off. It's lunchtime downtown. And there are whores and johns flying out of windows. People are hanging from window ledges. So it was Tex's turn to retaliate. So she sent the bomb. She got her competitor. So she took control of all of the massage parlor business downtown. But she used to come into the bar, you know, when I was, because I went from the first 2 years at the Tender Trap, I was the cocktail waiter, the dancing waiter. And then they moved me from there to the door. So I literally became the face of the Tender Trap. And so Tex would come in, she'd come in with her girls, and, you know, they'd go off and he'd sit at the bar with me or at the door with me and drink. And like when coworkers during my day job found out about this, they were just mortified that I even knew Tex, let alone drank with Tex. Even my mother flipped out. It's like his name's on the paper like every day. I'm like, you know, he's nice to me. You know, it's not like I can go anywhere. I'm stuck at the door. But I do remember one of my housemates, I think it was his first night working at the bar. Now, he was probably a little shorter than me. So let's say 5'6". Okay. Now, Tex was not big by any stretch of the imagination. If Tex was 5 foot, Tex was doing well. But Tex was very, very large. So my housemate walks up to Tex and says, "Can I get you a drink, ma'am?" She grabbed him by his shirt front, put him against the wall, and picked him up. So his feet are dangling like a foot off the floor. And Tex looks at him and says, "Don't you ever call me ma'am. You call me sir." Then she said, Tex set him down, and he made a beeline away from there as fast as he could. I mean, Tex would use the men's room. And when Tex walked into the men's room, you knew it, because everybody that was in there flew out. And rumor has it that Tex used the urinal. I don't want to know how. But it was an absolute character. That's for sure. But, you know, I mean, you know, Tex and Lucky were friends. Like I say, it was a very, very tight community. And like at the Tender Trap, you know, we, because of the way Michael ran the bar, because with Dick being essentially an owner, you know, in absentia, we were a family. You know, it was not uncommon for Michael to have us to his house for dinner. You know, when he would throw a Christmas party at the bar for us, you know, the bar would close, you know, whatever day it was before Christmas. And after the bar closed, then it was open bar. He bought, and we would do a grab bag, you know, a Secret Santa. But then he would have Christmas gifts for every one of his employees. And I mean, I'd be hard pressed to say I've ever worked for a better employer than Michael. Others might disagree with me. But you know, I still have a very good relationship with him. We're still in touch. Many of my former coworkers from the Tender Trap, we're still, in communication with each other. We see each other, you know, when we can, not right now, but, and I think most of the bars were that way in that, you know, the employees were all tight. And that's why I said earlier, you know, you made a point of knowing all of the other, you know, bar employees, because like on the weekends, we had a cover charge. Well, if you were a bar employee, you didn't get charged. You know, you got in free. So, you know, it was on me to know who the current employees were so that I didn't make a social faux pas. You know, and offend somebody working at another bar. And it, you know, and then of course it worked in my, well, some would say it was in my favor. I might argue that sometime, but like if I would go out drinking, I'm going to use the word, nobody dared charge me. It was just like an unwritten rule. Like I didn't get charged. Why? I don't know. But it ended up, it would usually end up being a more expensive evening because then I had to like over tip.
Right.
So it's like, just let me buy my fucking drink.
Now you mentioned in the article, Lucky After Dark, that you were part of a group in Pittsburgh that was known as the Untouchables. Who were those people and how did that name come about?
That was a name given to us. There was a group of us, and I can only remember two other people that were in that group, one of whom you know. But it was a name that was given to us, and again, I didn't know about this until long after, you know, the Tender Trap was gone. And I was having dinner with some friends, and somehow it came up in conversation about, you know, oh, you were part of a group we called the Untouchables. I'm like, excuse me? They're like, yeah, you were, you know, part of that group. You know, everybody wanted to be with, everybody wanted to run with, everybody wanted to party with, but nobody knew a thing about any of you because we were very careful that we kept our bar lives separate from our personal lives. And I remember once the young man who had the interaction with Tex, I had got word that he had gone to work one night, and then I heard later that, you know, he was reporting everything that we were, the goings on in the house. And so the next time I saw him, I cornered him. I said, don't you ever dare do that again. You know, it's like kind of like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. It's like that's nobody's business outside to know outside of this house what I do in my personal life. You know, nobody's paying my bills. They have no right to any of that information. And it was one of those things, for some strange reason in Pittsburgh, everybody knew everybody's business, even, you know, the bar employees. So, you know, to be part of a group where people didn't know anything about you other than what you let them know drove them nuts. I didn't care.
Yeah, things were different back then. There were a lot of nosy bodies. There was a lot of chatter.
It was still a time, you know, at least here in Pennsylvania, it was a period in time where, you know, a lot of people, you didn't know their last name for fear of, you know, if something came down, you know, you couldn't take them down with you. You know, people could potentially lose their jobs. You know, we had no protections back then. They didn't get those kind of protections until the mid-80s in Pittsburgh, you know, housing protection and job protection. So, you know, I mean, it was in the late 70s when Milton Schaap was the governor, because up to that point, you know, being queer was still considered to be a psychic, you know, an abnormality. You know, you were on the list of, you know, like psychoses and neuroses and all of that. And because the governor's son was gay, he actually had an executive order removing that. And, you know, I'm trying to think how it went. It gave some protections to us, but of course it was only good for as long as he was governor. So once his term was over, and I don't even know if he got a second term. So, you know, it was one of the reasons, you know, I don't want people knowing, you know. Plus, I mean, I have a daytime job. You know, I don't need this, you know, getting to my employer. Because I know, you know, people were worried when they had the first gay pride here in Pittsburgh. You know, if they were seen, you know, were they going to lose their job if their employer saw them?
Absolutely. I remember I was asked by a friend in Atlanta to start running a gay publication, a gay nightlife publication in Atlanta in the late 80s. Okay. And I did. I decided to accept his offer. And, but suddenly, even in the late 80s, that put me in a situation where every time I interacted with a potential client or any business in town, I was essentially outing myself to everybody, because yep. I was representing a gay business, and yep. You know, there was no way around it. And I remember thinking and having friends ask me at that time, you know, how weird is that? Because you're suddenly, like I said, outing yourself to everybody that you meet if you hope to have any business relationship with them. And even at that time, that was a little awkward. You know, there were not a lot of people who were that openly gay. And everybody, by the way, you know, a lot of people who are listening to this, if they're younger, may not know this, but back then, everything was gay. So there was no conversation about lesbian. There was gay men and women. All the nonprofit organizations were called gay. It wasn't the lesbian and gay or the LGBTQ or anything. Yeah. It was gay. The bars were gay. Lesbian bars were gay. So it was just one kind of universal label that we have kind of gotten away from. And now they're starting to go back with this alternate version of queer, which to a lot of people who are over 50 is pretty offensive because of the way it was used, you know, 30 years ago. But
it's one of those words, though, that, you know, at least in some areas, you know, we're taking it back.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
so,
and your local history archive there is called the Pittsburgh Queer History Project. So it's becoming more acceptable, and I'm kind of glad to see that.
I think it's also, you know, I don't want to say it's totally analogous with, but, you know, for me to call another gay man that is kind of like they say, you know, when, you know, two African Americans use the N-word, you know, something on that border, you know, it takes on a completely different tone when it comes from somebody outside the community.
Absolutely.
You know, and I don't have a problem, you know, calling myself queer. I mean, it wasn't until, God, when I worked at IKEA, that was the first place I ever, it was the first company I ever worked where I could be openly out and not fear for my job, which was such a relief and so liberating.
Absolutely.
But we digress.
And I think, you know, we got there because of what the gay bars did for our culture. They created our community. They allowed us to meet other like-minded people and to build communities and build organizations and build a network of people that we could depend upon to help move us forward for, you know, social rights and civil rights and everything that we have today. So,
And for so many, that was the only support network they had. You know, if they had been disowned by their family, I ceased to exist for about 2 years in my father's world when he found out. I mean, he didn't go as far as, excuse me, legally disinheriting me, but in word he did. Yeah, he didn't. He only had one son. You know, and I know it wrecked my mother. But, you know, because she had known for quite some time. But so, you know, there were other friends of mine who weren't even that lucky to have one supportive parent. You know, they were thrown out of their homes. So, yeah.
It was a tough time. But yeah. I'm glad I've had the chance in this last couple of years to explore a lot of the stories of people like yourself and the dozens of other people that I've interviewed and put this in perspective so that the generations that come after us will understand, you know, what our lives were like, what the bar scene was like, what the community development process was, and learn from that so that they can move forward and make further progress. And I really appreciate you taking the time to kind of walk us through some of Pittsburgh's history so we can add that to the mix and let people know that it was the case there as well.
My pleasure. I mean, I think it's very important to understand, as I, you know, mentioned to you in the email, that, you know, it's important to understand where you've been to know, so you know where you're going to.
Absolutely.
Because without that, I mean, you're essentially rudderless. You know, where are you going? You're just, you know, kind of wandering. I mean, if I had a chance, I'd go back and live it all over again. I'd do some things differently.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode or to find more episodes, visit gabearchives.com.